This is audiobook in MP3 of Deathbed Visions, The Psychical Experiences of the Dying, of Sir William Barrett. Published, 1926 pages in the original, was 123. Availability, out of print. Footnotes not always reading here. Preface, Editor's Preface. William Barrett. This book is sent out to the public in an unfinished state. It will be seen that in the introduction the author has only sketched the line of discussion which he would have elaborated, and even this outline is incomplete. The editor prefers, however, to leave untouched both the introduction and the discussion of cases, believing that by so doing the thought of the author will be more truly conveyed than would be the case were any elaboration undertaken by another hand. The outline was clearly unfinished, for several passages in the books of reference had been marked by him for discussion, and particularly paragraphs in Professor Botchano's recently published book, Phenomens Psychiques au Moment de la Mort, translated from Italian to French by C. Devesme, Editions de la BPS, 8 Rue Copernic, 16C, Paris, 1923. He was specially interested in Botchano's observation that if the phenomena were caused by the thoughts of the dying person being directed to those he loved, the appearances might be expected to represent living persons at least as frequently as deceased persons who had long passed from this world, whereas no records had come to hand of dying persons seeing at their bedside visions of friends still living. He would have liked to ask those who believe the visions to be the product of intense desire or thought to collect evidence in support of their theory, showing that desire for living friends may produce visions of them at the bedside seen during moments of full consciousness. There are, no doubt, cases of so-called traveling clairvoyance, see Chapter 4, in which the dying persons, after a period of trance or unconsciousness, said they had seen living relatives at a distance, and there was in some instances reciprocal vision by the distant relative of the figure of the dying person usually mistaken for a real appearance. This is clearly a very different type of phenomenon. Another point which the author had discussed with friends was that in the cases of phantasms of the living collected by the Society for Psychical Research it has usually been the person thinking, and not the one thought of, whose image was projected in vision. On this analogy, when a dying person sees the phantasm of one already deceased, the initiative would appear to come from the thought of the latter, whose survival is thereby demonstrated. He was greatly impressed by a feature not uncommon at the deathbeds of young children, viz., the description of the vision in terms not in keeping with ideas arising from their religious upbringing. He considered that in such circumstances the hallucination could hardly be ascribed to a mere flight of fancy. In arranging the groups of cases, he gave the first place to those relating to visions of a deceased person whom the dying percipient did not know to be dead. A recent and striking experience was that of Mrs. B., the first narrative in Chapter 2. He recognized that where the death was known to anybody present in the room, an attempt might be made to stretch telepathy to cover the incident, but he maintained that such an explanation would not account for the cases in this chapter, in which the percipient and the bystanders were equally unaware of the death. The author had given considerable time and thought to the subject, and looked forward to making the groups of cases as complete and representative as possible before publication. This, however, was not to be, for he himself, in the midst of active work, passed suddenly into that little-known country towards which his thought had so often taken wing. He was anxious to prove that even people who have been skeptical all their lives of any survival after death have sometimes given evidence that at the very end they knew there was an afterlife. He did not therefore choose material representing visions seen only by believers in survival of the soul, or by those with special psychic powers, but also visions seen by people with no belief in a future life. See cases at the end of Chapter 3. He put each case fairly, without keeping weak points in the background, and he left it to the reader himself to consider how far telepathy or some other mental attributes could be stretched to cover the circumstances. He expected impartial critics to realize that sometimes such an explanation would appear itself to involve a flight or extension of the soul incompatible with the material bounds of life. It is hoped that this little book, though it falls short of what the author contemplated, will to some extent carry out his plan and direct attention in this country to phenomena which seems to him to deserve more study than they have received. The editor gratefully acknowledges the help given by Mr. Trethewey, in his careful reading of the manuscript, in preparation of the index and in many valuable suggestions. April 1926. William Barrett. Chapter 1, Introduction. It is well known that there are many remarkable instances where a dying person, shortly before his or her transition from the earth, appears to see and recognize some deceased relatives or friends. We must, however, remember the fact that hallucinations of the dying are not very infrequent. Nevertheless, there are instances where the dying person was unaware of the previous death of the spirit form he sees, and is therefore astonished to find in the vision of his or her deceased relative one whom the percipient believes to be still on earth. These cases form, perhaps, one of the most cogent arguments for survival after death, as the evidential value and veridical, truth-telling, character of these visions of the dying is greatly enhanced when the fact is undeniably established that the dying person was wholly ignorant of the decease of the person he or she so vividly sees. With reference to these visions, that eminent physiologist of European fame, Professor Richer, writes as follows: "Facts of this kind are very important. They are much more explicable on the spiritist theory than by the hypothesis of mere cryptesthesia. Among all the facts adduced to prove survival, these seem to me to be the most disquieting, that is from a materialistic point of view. I have therefore thought it a duty to be scrupulous in mentioning them." As is well known, Professor Richer does not believe in the existence of a soul, or of survival after death, and explains the evidence afforded by psychical research of a spiritual world by his theory of cryptesthesia, by which he means the perception of things or beings, by some sensory organ at present unknown to science, a faculty not possessed by everyone, but, in my opinion, conclusively established to exist in certain individuals. These sensitives are to be found in all countries, in both sexes, and may be old or young, rich or poor, educated or ignorant. This faculty of clairvoyance, this vision of persons or things invisible to normal eyesight, may occur when the sensitive is quite conscious, but is more often observed in the trance condition, especially when this is induced by deep hypnosis, the mesmeric trance as it used to be called. The older mesmerists employed the word lucidity, or traveling clairvoyance, for the perception of things at a distance. The term clairvoyance is, however, ambiguous, for it is now used in two different senses, namely, either for, a, the perception of hidden material objects remote from the sensitive, such as underground water, or, b, for the perception by the sensitive of immaterial objects, such as apparitions of deceased persons. To avoid this confusion, Myers suggested the term telesthesia instead of clairvoyance for the perception of material things. Telesthesia he defines as the sensation or perception of objects or conditions independently of the recognized channels of sense, and also independently of any possible telepathic communication as the source of the knowledge thus gained. Hence the term telesthesia would be inapplicable to apparitions of the dead or visions of the dying, whereas Richer would include both of these, as well as the vision of hidden material things, under his word cryptesthesia, which appears to have the same connotation as the familiar word clairvoyance, and therefore it labors under the same ambiguity as that word. Other terms for clairvoyance have been suggested. In America, Mr. Henry Holt uses the word telopsis, and Dr. Hazinger the word telekinesis, but these terms could hardly be applied to apparitions or visions of the dying, which appear near to, and not far from, the sensitive. Miss Coy in her Peak in Darien makes some interesting remarks on the subject of visions of the dying. She states, "The dying person is lying quietly, when suddenly, in the very act of expiring, he looks up, sometimes starts up in bed and gazes on, what appears to be, vacancy, with an expression of astonishment, sometimes developing instantly into joy, and sometimes cut short in the first emotion of solemn wonder and awe. If the dying man were to see some utterly unexpected but instantly recognized vision, causing him a great surprise, or rapturous joy, his face could not better reveal the fact. The very instant this phenomenon occurs, death is actually taking place, and the eyes glaze even while they gaze at the unknown sight. As regards the general subject of visions of the dying, Mr. Myers has some interesting remarks in Phantasms of the Living. He states that in his view such an occurrence it must probably often take place, though it can seldom leave any record behind it. For here we have an account of that side only of a reciprocal incident which is usually lost to human knowledge altogether, I mean of the supernormal percipience of a man in the very article of death, while there is no record of any corresponding sound or vision as experienced by those to whom he seemed to pay his visit of farewell. There are, however, several cases on record where the vision of those who have passed over is shared by friends at the bedside of the dying person. Instances of these will be given in the later chapter. In considering the value of evidence for supernormal phenomena, the importance of the cumulative character of the evidence must be taken into account. It is the undesigned coincidence of witnesses who have had no communication with each other that constitutes its value taken as a whole, whilst a single case may be doubtful or disproved, just as a single stick may be broken but a faggot may defy all our attempts at breaking a bundle of sticks. On this point Archbishop Whately has some admirable remarks on the value of testimony. He states, "It is evident that when many coincide in their testimony, where no previous concert can have taken place, the probability resulting from this concurrence does not rest on the supposed veracity of each considered separately, but on the improbability of such an agreement taking place by chance. For though in such a case each of the witnesses should be considered as unworthy of credit, and even much more likely to speak falsehood than truth, still the chances would be infinite against their all agreeing in the same falsehood." About 50 years ago, the learned incumbent of a church in Birmingham, the Reverend J.S. Pollock, published a collection of cases of supernormal phenomena under the curious title of Dead and Gone. Although some 500 cases are quoted, taken from various sources, no attempt has been made at the investigation of any single case, so that the book as a whole has little evidential value. Here I may quote some suggestive remarks made by Mrs. Henry Sidgwick soon after the foundation of the Society for Psychical Research, and published in the Proceedings for 1885, p. 69. Most of those to whom this paper is addressed probably belong to some Christian denomination, and to them the continued existence of the soul after death is, of course, no new theory invented to account for such phenomena as we are discussing, or requiring such phenomena to support it. But few will have any difficulty in agreeing with me that 1. The possibility of receiving visions of or communications from the dead, here and now, would not follow as a necessary consequence from the immortality of the soul. 2. That if communication of what I may call an objective kind distinguishable, I mean, from our own thoughts and emotions is possible to all those of the departed who desire it, we should naturally expect it to occur more frequently than the most sanguine can suppose that it actually does, and 3, that its possibility, while not in contradiction with any of the known facts of physical science, is certainly not supported, or in any way suggested, by any of these facts. However firmly, therefore, we may believe in the continued existence of dead human beings, we cannot regard a supposition of their action on the minds of the living as if it were merely the reference of an effect to a vira corsa known to be adequate to produce it. We must treat it as we should treat the hypothesis in any department of physical investigation of an entirely new agent, for the existence of which we have no evidence outside the phenomenon which it is introduced to explain. If this be so, it will, I think, be admitted that we should be violating an established rule of scientific method if we introduced such a hypothesis except in the last resort, when all other modes of explanation seem clearly to fail. Exactly at what point of improbability this failure of other explanations is to be regarded as established, cannot, I think, be defined. At any rate, I feel quite unable to define it. But I may perhaps say that, in my opinion, it is a point which can hardly be reached in the case of any narrative of a single event considered by itself, If we had only a single Egost story to deal with, I can hardly conceive the kind or amount of evidence which would lead me to prefer the hypothesis of ghostly agency to all other possible explanations. The existence, therefore, of phantasms of the dead can only be established, if at all, by the accumulation of improbabilities in which we become involved by rejecting a large mass of apparently strong testimony to facts which, as recounted, would seem to admit of no other satisfactory explanation, and in testing the value of this testimony we are bound, I think, to strain to the utmost all possible suppositions of recognized causes, before we can regard the narrative in question as even tending to prove the operation of this novel agency. On the other hand, every scientific society ought to have as its motto the opinion expressed by Sir John Herschel in his Discourse on Natural Philosophy, p. 127, that the perfect observer will have his eyes as it were opened that they may be struck at once with any occurrence which, according to received theories, ought not to happen, for these are the facts which serve as clues to new discoveries. Unfortunately, as Goethe remarked in one of his conversations with Eckermann, in the sciences, if anyone advances anything new, people resist with all their might, they speak of the new view with contempt, as if it were not worth the trouble of even so much as an investigation or a regard, and thus a new truth may wait a long time before it can win its way. Chapter 2, Visions Seen by the Dying of Persons by Them Unknown to be Dead. The evidence of visions of the dying, when they appear to see and recognize some of their relatives of whose decease they were unaware, affords perhaps one of the strongest arguments in favor of survival. Even Professor Risher regards this evidence as impossible to explain by cryptesthesia. I have given some striking instances of these visions of the dying in my book On the Threshold of the Unseen, and other cases will be found in the proceedings of our society. A recent case of the kind was related to me by Lady Barrett, which occurred when she was in attendance on a patient in the Mother's Hospital, at Clapton, of which she is one of the obstetric surgeons. Lady Barrett received an urgent message from the resident medical officer, Dr. Phillips, to come to a patient, Mrs. B., who was in labor and suffering from serious heart failure. Lady Barrett went at once, and the child was delivered safely, though the mother was dying at the time. After seeing other patients, Lady Barrett went back to Mrs. B.'s ward, and the following conversation occurred, which was written down soon afterwards. Lady Barrett says, "When I entered the ward, Mrs. B. held out her hands to me and said, 'Thank you for what you have done for me for bringing the baby. Is it a boy or girl?' Then holding my hand tightly, she said, 'Don't leave me, don't go away. Will you?' And after a few minutes, while the house surgeon carried out some restorative measures, she lay looking up towards the open part of the room, which was brightly lighted, and said, 'Oh, don't let it get dark, it's getting so dark. Darker and darker.' Her husband and mother were sent for. Suddenly she looked eagerly towards one part of the room, a radiant smile illuminating her whole countenance. 'Oh, lovely, lovely,' she said. I asked, 'What is lovely? What I see?' she replied in low, intense tones. 'What do you see?' 'Lovely brightness, wonderful beings.' It is difficult to describe the sense of reality conveyed by her intense absorption in the vision. Then seeming to focus her attention more intently on one place for a moment, she exclaimed, almost with a kind of joyous cry, 'Why, it's father. Oh, he's so glad I'm coming, he is so glad. It would be perfect if only W. her husband could come too.' Her baby was brought for her to see. She looked at it with interest, and then said, 'Do you think I ought to stay for baby's sake?' Then turning towards the vision again, she said, I can't stay. If you could see what I do, you would know I can't stay.' But she turned to her husband, who had come in, and said, 'You won't let baby go to anyone who won't love him, will you?' Then she gently pushed him to one side, saying, 'Let me see the lovely brightness.' I left shortly after, and the materne took my place by the bedside. She lived for another hour, and appeared to have retained to the last the double consciousness of the bright forms she saw, and also of those tending her at the bedside. For example, she arranged with the matron that her premature baby should remain in hospital till it was strong enough to be cared for in an ordinary household. Signed, Florence E. Barrett. Dr. Phillips, who was present, after reading the above notes, writes to me saying that she fully agrees with Lady Barrett's account. The most important evidence is, however, given by the matron of the hospital, who has sent the following account. I was present shortly before the death of Mrs. B., together with her husband and her mother. Her husband was leaning over her and speaking to her, when pushing him aside once she said, "Oh, don't hide it, it's so beautiful." Then turning away from him towards me, I being on the other side of the bed, Mrs. B. said, "Oh, why does Vida," referring to a sister of whose death 3 weeks previously she had not been told. Afterwards, the mother, who was present at the time, told me, as I have said, that Vida was the name of a dead sister of Mrs. B.S., of whose illness and death she was quite ignorant, as they had carefully kept this news from Mrs. B., owing to her serious illness. Signed, Miriam Castle. Matron, 1. This is not the incident mentioned by Lady Barrett, but a later incident of the same kind. I asked Dr. Phillips to try and obtain the independent report of Mrs. B.S. mother, who, as the matron stated, was also present at the time. This was kindly done, and I have received the following interesting and informative letter from Mrs. Clark, Mrs. B.S. mother. I have heard you are interested in the beautiful passing of my dear daughter's spirit from this earth on the 12th day of January, 1924. The wonderful part of it is the history of the death of my dear daughter, Vida, who had been an invalid some years. Her death took place on the 25th day of December, 1923, just 2 weeks and 4 days before her younger sister, Doris, died. My daughter Doris, Mrs. B., was very ill at that time, and the matron at the mother's hospital deemed it unwise for Mrs. B. to know of her sister's death. Therefore, when visiting her, we put off our mourning and visited her as usual. All her letters were also kept by request until her husband had seen who they might be from before letting her see them. This precaution was taken lest outside friends might possibly allude to the recent bereavement in writing to her, unaware of the very dangerous state of her health. When my dear child was sinking rapidly, at first she said, "It is all so dark, I cannot see." A few seconds after, a beautiful radiance lit up her countenance. I know now it was the light of heaven, and it was most beautiful to behold. My dear child said, "Oh, it is lovely and bright, you cannot see as I can." She fixed her eyes on one particular spot in the ward, saying, "Oh, God, forgive me for anything I have done wrong." After that she said, "I can see Father, he wants me, he is so lonely." She spoke to her father, saying, "I am coming," turning at the same time to look at me, saying, "Oh, he is so near." On looking at the same place again, she said with rather a puzzled expression, "He has Vida with him," turning again to me saying, "Vida is with him." Then she said, "You do want me, Dad, I am coming." Then a very few parting words or sighs were expressed, nothing very definite or clear. With great difficulty and a very hard strain she asked to see the man who married us. This was to her husband, who was standing on the opposite side of the bed. His name she could not say. It was the Reverend Morris Davis, of All Saints, Haggerston, E., and he was sent for too. He had known my dear child for some years, and was so impressed by the vision that he quoted it in his parish magazine for February last. Yours respectfully, signed, Mary C. Clark. Before passing on to other cases, it is desirable to discuss somewhat in detail the foregoing case. The vision seen by the dying woman, Mrs. B., was obviously not due to her normal sight, otherwise the figures would have been seen by others present in the room. The appearance therefore was not due to any ordinary material objects, nor is it likely to have been due to some illusion, that is to say, the misinterpretation of some object actually present to sight, as when a dressing gown is mistaken for a woman, for not only was there nothing in the room to suggest such an illusion, But she recognized both her deceased father and sister. Moreover, she was quite unaware of the death of the latter. A more probable explanation is that it was an hallucination, which may be defined as a sensory perception which has no objective counterpart within the field of vision. The question therefore becomes whether it was merely a delusive hallucination, when there is nothing whatever to which it corresponds, or a veridical hallucination corresponding to some real event, which was invisible to normal eyesight. This must not be confused with a delusion, which applies to cases where there is no corresponding reality. There are many well-known cases of vivid illusions of sight which sometimes accompany the oncoming of sleep, as when a dream figure persists for a short time, or when faces in the dark are vividly seen by certain persons. These illusions are termed hypnagogic. Externalized impressions of this kind are the frequent source of imaginary apparitions, such as occur to nervous people walking through lonely places at night time. To many of my readers, this common sense explanation will appear to be the origin of the vision of the dying which we have just related, the whole matter being dismissed as a mere coincidence. If this case stood alone, this would be the probable explanation. It will, however, be seen that mere chance coincidence cannot apply to the numerous cases which will be recited later on. Another explanation is the creation of hallucination in the percipient by some transference of thought or telepathic influence from those around the bedside. In the case just recited, however, this explanation fails, for Lady Barrett and Dr. Phillips knew nothing about the decease of the percipient's father, when the latter, looking steadily at one place, said, "Why, it's father. Oh, he's so glad I'm coming." Nor was her husband present at the time. Moreover, the skeptical reader is likely to deny the existence of telepathy and would reject any explanation based upon that ground. The next case has reached me from America and is a well-authenticated instance on the authority of a distinguished man, Dr. Minute J. Savage, with whom I was acquainted. Dr. Minute Savage was for many years a valued member of RSPR. He died in 1920. Dr. Hislop III has recorded the following case in one of his books, Foreign Remarks. "Dr. Savage told me personally of the facts and gave me the names and addresses of the persons on whose authority he tells the incidents, which Dr. Savage narrates as follows. In a neighboring city were two little girls, Jenny and Edith, one about 8 years of age and the other but a little older. They were schoolmates and intimate friends. In June, 1889, both were taken ill of diphtheria. At noon on Wednesday, Jenny died. Then the parents of Edith, and her physician as well, took particular pains to keep from her the fact that her little playmate was gone. They feared the effect of the knowledge on her own condition. To prove that they succeeded and that she did not know, it may be mentioned that on Saturday, June 8th, at noon, just before she became unconscious of all that was passing about her, she selected two of her photographs to be sent to Jenny, and also told her attendants to bid her goodbye. She died at 6:30 on the evening of Saturday, June 8th. She had roused and bidden her friends goodbye, and was talking of dying, and seemed to have no fear. She appeared to see one and another of the friends she knew were dead. So far it was like other similar cases. But now suddenly, and with every appearance of surprise, she turned to her father and exclaimed, 'Why, Papa, I am going to take Jenny with me.' Then she added, 'Why, Papa, you did not tell me that Jenny was here.' And immediately she reached out her arms as if in welcome, and said, 'Oh, Jenny, I'm so glad you are here.'" 3. As some of my readers may not be acquainted with Dr. Hislop's name, I may mention that he was for some years the professor of ethics and logic in Columbia University, New York. He studied for some years in Germany, where he took his PhD and was also an LL.D. He was at first a skeptic and severe critic of psychical research, but afterwards became convinced of the importance of the subject, and resigned his university chair and all its emoluments to devote the rest of his life to the investigation of psychical phenomena. His zeal and energy and acumen were remarkable. In fact, he sacrificed his life through the incessant labor involved in his duties as treasurer, honorable secretary and research officer of the American SPR. His literary output was enormous, He seemed to live and move and have his being in psychical research to the exclusion of almost every other subject.